The following program is a production of KHNS. Its content does not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the board of directors and staff of Lynn Canal Broadcasting Incorporated, the licensee. Good morning. You're listening to KHNS, Haines, Skagway, and Kwekwan. Welcome to Lynn Canal Art Matters. My name is Janine, and the wonderful Heather Lendy is here.
The wonderful. I like that. I think that should be, everybody should just call me that. I should put that on my little name tags wherever I go.
Good morning, Heather.
Good morning, Janine. It's so nice to be here with you this morning. You've been out and about in the world and seen all kinds of stuff, and now you're back home again.
Yeah.
So that's nice. Very nice. And, of course, we're here because it's first Thursday, which means tomorrow's first Friday, and that's always so exciting here in Haines with everything happening. And the first Friday features this year include pottery and mixology at the local distillery, and on Main Street, Skipping Stone Studio is going to feature the pottery and ceramic work from Haines artist Carrie Cohen, who was one of our guests this morning. And next door, Brad Schultze, Schultz or Schultze, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. Do you know?
I'm not totally sure.
We'll have watercolor portraits on display, and I believe he's the same one that has that great portrait of the like the prospector or the miner or whatever that's in the windows there by Hauser's. It's really good. Like, it's kind of arresting. I've stopped a couple times, and I hadn't known of him or his work before. So we'll have a whole exhibit of that. And also, Katie Kirby, the tasting room manager for the Port Chilkoot Distillery, is going to offer mixology and the art of the cocktail. And the Haines Brewing Company is going to feature Sarah Bishop's sculptural work and woodblock prints. And Sarah is here as well. And also, this is something that we're going to do on the show today that's kind of fun. The house number one, the Fort Seward Bed and Breakfast, is having an open house because it changed hands and has a new owner. And then there's been some restoration of the old building. And I thought it would be fun to talk about the art of innkeeping. And so we'll have the keepers of the Fort Seward B&B and also of the Summer Inn, which is another historical home in Haines that is a bed and breakfast. So that's in the second half of the show. And what else? Oh, for our reading today, well, we've got some big news about Nobel Prizes and such that you're very good at, being a former librarian.
Yeah, the Nobel Prize award for literature was announced today, and it didn't go to a musician. So
it's not Bob Dylan this time, no. Tom Petty didn't get it?
Oh. Yeah, Kazuo Ishiguro won it. He's a British writer, and we can talk about that toward the end of the show. So
I love the way you can pronounce his name, which I was. That's why I asked you, because I'm afraid to do it. But The Remains of the Day is his book that probably most people would know, that was made into a movie about the English butler. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful book and movie. Film, I guess you're supposed to say, when we're on an art show. For our usual book checking in, I thought I'd check in with a couple of my my favorite hunters about moose tree stand reading, which is a whole nother genre that is popular this time of year.
And oh, I love radio, Heather. We just got a live update on pronunciation for Brad. It's Schultz.
Schultz.
Like the Peanuts cartoonist.
Right. Well, he's a great artist, and thank you. Thank you, Brad Schultz, for checking that, or whoever, friend of Brad. And I'm looking forward to seeing his art. So what should we just go ahead and start talking to Carrie and Sarah?
I think we should just delve in, yeah.
All right. So Carrie Cohen and Sarah Bishop are two artists that are displaying their works tomorrow night. And why don't you, Carrie, why don't you start and go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us what people can expect if they go and see your work.
Well, my name's Carrie, and I'm a ceramic artist. And I have mostly, I think in the past, I've done a lot of tile work and two-dimensional or bas-relief tile for like the work at the library. Mm-hmm. And I've used a lot of colorful glazes, and there's an aspect of pottery that has a really strong draw to me, and that is making hand-formed vessels that are in the natural clay color and then just leaving them raw like that, and then firing their pinch pots And so there's a lot of time in the process of just, I think it's probably a slower process than forming a pot on a wheel. Yeah, it's just really very appealing to work with the clay in that way. It's much more intimate with the clay than painting on the surface, painting a design. And so that's what I'm going to have at my show, is mostly the pinched pottery, and pretty much all of it is unglazed.
So for someone that isn't as familiar with pottery or hasn't taken a class with Mrs. Danner in the art room, the difference between a pinched pot and something that's on a wheel?
The wheel is a electric tool that's used by a potter to sit at, and it's spinning, and then they put a lump of clay on top of a disc that spins, and then they place their fingers inside the pot and outside the pot and provide pressure, and it pulls the walls of the pot into that vessel shape. And with a pinched pot, you're holding the lump of clay in your hand, and then you're pinching. You still have your thumb on the inside and your finger on the outside, but each move is a micro move. Yeah, and you're spinning still, but it's very slow motion.
So are pinch pots by nature then rougher, or would I be able to tell the difference, not being a super aficionado of ceramics, from a pinch pot and something on the wheel that you did?
You could definitely tell. Pinch pots take on more of an organic shape, where something that's thrown on a wheel, if the potter has skill, then it's going to be very centered and symmetrical. And you can do that when you're pinching a pot, but I think that's the beauty of pinching a pot, is that you can take it into an asymmetrical shape. And I love doing that.
It's more like, I guess, the first potters. I mean, that's what people did, right? When they came up with trying to make a vessel out of clay, they took it and molded it with their hands.
Probably, yeah. And I think like rolling coils and making,
right.
Stacking the coils one on top of another
was another way.
Yeah.
Huh. And is there a special clay that you use that is better for these than a different kind of clay that you would use on a wheel?
I have all different kinds of clays that come from different areas in the Pacific Northwest, and they fire to many different colors, ranging from black to, like a deep red and dark brown. The clay that I am mostly featuring in the show is a low fire clay that fires to a cone. It's maturing temperature. Well, this isn't really going to mean much to the most people, but it's about, I think it's 1850 centigrade. And and if you take it higher, which I've done, then it's melting slightly, and wow. And it makes the clay take on this really beautiful kind of a burnished look. And so that I've been experimenting with
See how warm you can go without destroying it.
Yes. Exactly.
That's a part of it too. I mean, the whole thing with pottery or ceramics is you have to be a bit of a chemist as well. And I love the things that I'm always interested in most with art is the line between art and craft, and the idea of oh, it's neat to make a pot, but then it's like you have to make it so that it actually works. It holds water, the glaze is there, it doesn't fall apart, all of these different, or whatever the parameters are that you're trying to do. But there's this other element to it in the firing, right?
Right, yeah. Well, that's an interesting point that you mentioned with some of the work in the show, is that I'm really not, the functionality wasn't the point. And so some of my pots are, like, I have, in the pinching process, I have pushed the clay so far that a crack has formed in the wall of the pot, and rather than you know, just discard the pot, that has become a feature of that pot.
Right.
That I really like that.
And
so that
yeah. it's an object of art.
Yes.
Wow. This is and now you're and I'll get to Sarah in a second, but this yeah. and your background, are you self-taught? Is this, are you university taught? Are you apprentice? How did you learn sort of to get this far?
I am completely self-taught. Just luck and circumstance that I found myself working in a clay studio early in life. And I think, you know, that when I was growing up, there were just a lot of art materials around the house. My mother was taking classes at the University of Montana in Missoula, and she was studying to be a black and white photographer. And so she was taking classes in composition, and she would come home with pieces of, you know, like piles of colored construction paper, and she was cutting them into rectangles and triangles and circles and putting those elements together. And as a child, I just thought that was really cool, and those materials were also available to me to play with. So,
and sitting right next to you is your daughter, Sarah Bishop, yes. who is also an artist, who maybe there's a connection here, the way this all runs through. So, Sarah, would you introduce yourself for us?
Yeah. So my name is Sarah Bishop, and I am the daughter of Carrie Cohen. And I am an artist as well. I suppose I probably started out with clay just because it was always around, and I ended up taking many art classes with Lena Stanner and then going to art school in the Bay Area, and I can't really say specifically that I'm a ceramic artist or a painter or a printer or a glass artist, or because I work in a lot of different mediums, and I suppose I do mostly 3D sculptural work, although this Friday I'll be showing block prints. So
so tell us then about what your exhibit at the brewery is going to include.
Okay, so I'll be showing a number of pieces that I created over the last couple years that are a combination of metal and textile and some glass, and they're sort of whimsical, very detailed little sculptures of moss, basically, and lichen, and woodland growths reinterpreted into fabric and found objects from the environment.
I've seen you at one. I remember one day I watched you. You had a camera. You were out at Chilkoot Lake, and you were taking little pictures of something very small that you were all excited about. And I forget now what it was exactly. And is this? Do you do that? Do you find inspiration by getting yourself a little photograph of that particular moss or lichen or whatever it is?
I do. I mean, I often will snap a photo if I'm out and I see a particular color combination that I really love and I don't want to forget, or, you know, a particular type of moss that I haven't seen before and I really like the shape of it, and I just say, ooh, I want to, you know, jog my memory with that later on.
And your work, I know at the school you've got a piece of art that's glass. The fishes, I think, they're above the doorway when you walk into the Haynes School. If you look up on your right, there's they're fish, and they're mounted on, I think it's wood?
On wood.
Yeah. And where'd you learn how to do the glass work?
I learned how to do glass, I guess, in the very beginning with John Svensson. He has a torch and sort of small-scale glass work studio, and then I went to school in Oakland and San Francisco, and there I learned how to blow glass and cast glass and work with cold glass.
And then didn't you travel to Japan and do some work there too? And what kind of art was that the focus on?
So I lived in Japan for a little over a year, and I went to a university there and specialized in glass as well. Mm-hmm. Mostly glass blowing, but also some cold working, it's called, so like polishing and grinding and sawing with big saws, and then a little bit of casting as well. Mm-hmm. So,
and then you also work in a lot of fabric. I mean, your pillows, for instance, people might have in their house, your vegetable pillows.
Yes, that's sort of another tangent in another direction, which actually kind of leads well into the block prints that I'll be showing at the brewery.
Perfect. Sarah, you are a pro at this. That was a really good segue. Thank you.
Thank you.
Getting me
thank
back you. To where we're supposed to be talking about. So the block prints, yes, tell us about them.
Well, so this year I've been helping to manage the Haynes Farmers Market. And I, throughout the course of the summer, I was getting really inspired by vegetables and people that farm. And so sort of like my vegetable pillows, I have been developing some woodblock prints of farmers and their veggies.
Mm-hmm. And who doesn't love farmers and their veggies?
That's right.
I mean,
that's
I think
right.
they'll be very popular, especially this time of year. Yeah. You know, I think, oh, that's a nice harvest season. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
So since we've got you both here, too, the family, the mother-daughter art connection, do you think there's something to that? Or do you think that there is a way that, say, people who maybe might not be all that artistic, who want to raise artistic children, is there any advice that might come from maybe Carrie?
Well, thinking about this question, I really feel like it was a gift my mother gave me just by providing materials and encouragement around the house, and encouragement when I would make something, and just a nice comment.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't necessarily feel like people are born with inherent artistic skill or creativity. I think it's really up to the parents to just encourage that and provide the opportunity. And then it just comes naturally because, you know, just like the other night we were out at the fireweed and Sarah was sitting with Garland and my granddaughter, Garland, Sarah's daughter, and she had crayons and she was drawing a line, you know, just like holding the crayon and pulling it towards her. And there's a line on the paper and we're all like, ooh, pretty, you know? And so, she's an artist.
Right.
Easy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think
Sarah, do you think about this? Do you think, well, gosh, what if my parents were like, you know, nuclear physicists or something, then I might not be a starving artist? Or do you think it's good? You know, I mean, I'm just curious how much you think is nature and nurture.
Oh, gosh.
Well, maybe that's too big a question. I mean, I guess just the whole, you know, living in an artistic environment, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, if they were nuclear physicists, perhaps not as many opportunities would have naturally presented themselves. And so then, you know, I probably would have ended up somewhere different. But I certainly don't think that it necessarily works. You know, if a parent was to say, okay, now be creative, or, you know, you need to learn to draw, or it would be the same as, like,
okay, you need to do math now.
You need to be a violinist or something.
Right.
It's like, well, maybe the child is going to.
But then there's the idea, I think, what Carrie was saying, too, the idea that, you know, you don't necessarily have to be that, but to have an appreciation for it. You know, if your parent is a musician and you grow up, and you're not particularly musical yourself, you still, you know, probably gravitate toward music. You listen to it. You might go to concerts. You might appreciate, and understand it more than somebody who didn't have that relationship, you
that's
know.
Probably
and
likely.
I think that's probably true with creativity. It's probably true of nuclear physicists too.
Yeah, probably.
the more we know about each other.
I was really lucky, I think, too, to have many, many neighbors that also are artists. And so it didn't feel like a kind of family phenomenon so much as just a lot of the people that I knew all made art in some way. And so, I think it was kind of a natural.
I know, this is interesting. Evolution. You're part of a generation there's a bunch of young people, you know, who grew up in Haines who now are artists or working in very artistic, creative ways in all kinds of different genres or mediums or whatever. And I think there is something to it, that it's valued in the school district, it's valued in the community, the arts council, it's valued, you know, on Main Street, and all these First Fridays are sort of a natural evolution of the fact that our community is artistic, and it could be argued has been since time immemorial. If you go back to the first people here had time for art and place that high, you know, the design and carving and sculpture and weaving and all of it. So it's pretty interesting that continuum is still in this place and that it's still a value here. Is there, now speaking of that, is there something that you think, the best thing that people in the community can do to support artists, both young and maturing?
Well, I think I actually heard you say this once in the past, that if people really want to support artists, then they can buy art.
Buy art, right.
Which is a really wonderful thing if you have the means to do.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, just in terms of, you know, First Friday, like you said, or all of the local venues.
Like the farmer's market, like you say, right.
But, oh, well, to sell, but also just to show work, like the brewery and the distillery and galleries on Main Street, and there's a few new galleries now too, and just
even the bank. I mean, it started way back when Flagel was the manager of the bank. There was always an art exhibit there from when you were teeny tiny, and there still is. So there are a lot of opportunities. But I think you're right. I heard that line about buying art from a woman who was the former head of the state council on the arts, and she said that at a big thing on the arts in Juneau last winter with the governor there, and that's what she said. She said, all of you people that are here gathered, if you like art, buy some and give it away. If you have too much at your house, buy something and give it to somebody. But think locally first, and think local Alaskan artists first.
Yeah. And I also would like to add that I think having an art teacher in the school is really a critical position. And I know that always comes up sometimes, you know, in school, when a school district is trying to save money, that the art and music teachers are the, you know, it's just assumed that, oh yes, we need math and we need English and we need these other subjects, but I think having an art teacher is critical.
Great. I think that's a great line to end our conversation on, so we can get to the next guest. But thank you so much for coming in. I'm looking forward to seeing the pinch pots and the block prints and everything. So anyway, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thank you, Heather.
Yep.
music from Eric Holly. He has a brand new CD, and we've been trying to feature local musicians on this program, Heather. His new CD called The Flip Side of Perfection, Eric Holly's Greatest Hits. I was really happy to hear that here. See that here at the
Flip
radio
Side of Perfection. That's a good title for a book, too.
Yeah.
And that's where we're moving right into our book segment, which is always part of Art Matters. And also storytelling. I was recently at the Tutka Bay Writers Retreat outside of Homer, and the featured author that was there was Louise Erdick, who she wrote La Rose or Love Medicine, A Plague of Doves. Mm-hmm. Anyway, she's a real well-known author with and she's a Native American. And she said that she thought there was something genetic about a narrative and telling a story, that it's part of our human DNA to tell stories, and it's a survival instinct that is deep within us. And certainly one of the things that helps us survive the winter here is River Talk, which are personal stories that people tell. And that's starting again this month. And the first evening of River Talk is My Brush with Fame. And the first show is going to be Thursday, October 19th at 7. And it's also going to feature a visiting rhetorician, author, and educator, who also kind of lives here and is a KGNS volunteer, Dan Henry. So he will be here then, too. But if you'd like to tell a story at River Talk, get in touch with Carol Tyneman, and you can get in touch with her at First Friday down at the Arts Confluence office. And you had some news about sort of big literary news, right?
Well, yeah, and I guess we sort of mentioned it, but the Nobel Prize in Literature was announced this morning, and it's Kazuo Ishiguro. He wrote, we talked about The Remains of the Day. He also wrote When We Were Orphans, Never Let Me Go. He's written a lot of books at this point, and I'm going straight to the library after this show to pick up one of those, because I've never read anything by him.
You've never read Remains of the Day?
No.
Oh, I love that book. And it actually fits in with our next guests, who are innkeepers. You know, it's about an English butler. And so, you know, there's some of those sort of things with it. But it's a beautiful book. And I guess I was heartened that he's only written 8 novels and he got the Nobel Prize. I thought you had to write like 50 or something. So not that mine... anything I write would ever be quite at that level, but it was it's neat. And he's a Japanese Englishman. Mm-hmm. So he moved from Japan when he was 5 to England and went through all the schools and stuff there, so that's his background.
Yeah, and I know the literary world is a little bit relieved that there's a lot of different opinions about Bob Dylan winning last year, but it was definitely a surprise for a lot of people. And so
the songs aren't quite literature or poetry. It's a different thing.
It was a huge debate, but a lot of people this morning on the internet were like, oh, good, a writer won.
Well, there you go. Speaking of seasonal reading and writing, I usually like to have a reader on the show to talk about the books that they're reading. And this time of year is now just sort of ending for most of us. But the moose hunting season is a season for many for reading, because one of the strategies in moose hunting is to sit in a tree stand for hours and hours and not move. And most of the tree stands where you are without internet or devices or anything, you're not supposed to have those kind of things when you're hunting anyhow. So a book is a and you can't have music because, you know, the moose can hear it. And so a book is the thing that you have with you. And so I talked to, and it's also, reading can also be something that happens in the summertime with commercial fishermen. And so I talked to Don Nash, who's a troller as well as a moose hunter. And I asked him, and I know he's an avid reader, and I asked him to, what kind of books does he read on a boat and in a moose stand? And he says anything with an action, adventure, or a romantic plot. He likes Jack Reacher, you know, Lee Child's kind of detective. Kay Scarpetta, that's Patricia Cornwall's murder mystery crime stuff. That's her protagonist. And and I've heard this from several other fishermen as well. Louis L'Amour, The Sacketts, anything by Louis L'Amour. And my husband said, and I think this is probably true as well for fishing, that the trick is in choosing a book for hunting or for something that you're doing, you know, reading while you're doing something else, is that it has to have lots of breaks, short paragraphs, short chapters, and you can't be so enthralled that you don't look up for moose or fish or whatever it is you're doing. And it has to have a lot of action, and this is particularly true for moose hunting, to keep you awake so you don't fall asleep in the tree stand. Also, this is interesting for those of us who are hard book people like myself, that that especially moose tree stand reading sometimes is better on a device because they're more waterproof. They're easier to keep your place in, and they have a little bit of a backlight so you can see, but you can't really have a light if you're in a tree stand early in the morning, you know, for the to see. And they're smaller to put in a pocket or in your pack than a paperback might be. So that's one of the good uses for a device. And I asked Chip what he read in his preferred tree stand reading, and this year it was The Orphan Master's Son. Adam Johnson, it's about North Korea, which will make you really scared about what's happening there when you read this novel about how close that society is and how much the propaganda of whatever's happening there is infiltrated into the people. It's pretty scary if the novel, which won the Pulitzer Prize, is anything like reality. And Daniel Silva, who writes about an Israeli assassin who's also a old master painter, art restorer. Gabriel Alon is his detective. And then The Miracle of Dunkirk, which is, they're making that movie now, Dunkirk, but it was by Walter Lord, and it's about the evacuation of the Allied forces from Dunkirk. And I guess it really reads like a novel. It's a gripping story about really one of the largest evacuations of all time and how that happened. And the one thing about it that was pretty neat was how many dogs they evacuated. They took animals. They took about 150 dogs that were on the beach and brought them back. And that's the Brits. You know, they love their animals. And I thought that was very sweet. Anyway, that's our book conversation for the morning.
Yeah, I like the moose hunting reading. I hadn't thought about that.
It's a big part of moose hunting because the idea is to stay in the tree stand as long as you can. At least that's some hunter strategies. And I think that tends to be the best one from my experience, but there's a lot of reading that gets done when you're moose hunting. So there you have it. And now we're going to talk with our innkeepers, the art of innkeeping. And this came about because, of course, first Friday there's an open house at the Fort Seward Bed and Breakfast. It's number one.
House number one,
the former surgeon's house that is under new ownership after many years and has been renovated and has a new innkeeper, and also the summer inn. So maybe let's start with Allie. Why don't you introduce yourself? As I always ask everybody to introduce themselves as the way they want to be, and you're the innkeeper at the Fort Seward B&B.
Right? Except we have to call it House Number One.
It's House Number One now. Is there a new name?
This is all part of it. Uh-huh. Yeah, House Number One. But then afterwards we just say Fort Seward Bed and Breakfast because that's what everybody knows it as. And I think the Summer Inn has the same kind of thing going on at the moment. So I've been working for JJ as innkeeper since July.
And JJ is?
JJ Gorin. He's a local fisherman, a young fella. He has a decade of association here in Haines. Mm-hmm.
And he's the new owner.
He is indeed, mm-hmm. yeah. So I came on board just in July as innkeeper. Prior to that, I was... he gave me a very fancy title. I was director of housekeeping, which basically I got awarded because I know how to hang pictures well, which he was really struggling with. How do you hang pictures so that they, when the wires on the back aren't all exactly the same, how do you measure to make a row of pictures level? And of course, that's something they teach us in art school. So,
There you go.
So
the art of that. This is there good. The art of innkeeping. Now we know
it involves the art of hanging old pictures that don't really match each other. Mm-hmm. So innkeeping. It's a different situation for me in that I'm working with an owner. Mm-hmm. In the past, I've run my own bed and breakfast, and of course, I have complete free rein within the constraints of, you know, financial things and so on. But so this has been an interesting challenge, But both JJ and I found that the house itself is kind of calling the shots on on what it wants to be, and being aware of trying to pull it back but modernize at the same time. So mm-hmm. we're trying to provide better facilities and comfort for our guests, but keeping that, the feel of the historic house is paramount for us both, mm-hmm. which is great. So yeah, the house is in charge. We have to. And maybe it's the spirit of the Surgeon General, whatever his name was, that fellow. I'm going to do some research down at the museum over the winter to find out more about the very first person who lived there, because I think he had a lot of control as to what that house is, the mm-hmm. design of it, the layout, and so on. And
well, of course, you know, Norm and Suzanne Smith owned the home for years,
absolutely.
And Norm grew up there. And his father, Norm Sr., is a historian, so mm-hmm. I'm sure mm-hmm. there's a lot
yeah.
of information
yeah.
on that yeah. home in particular and the people who lived in it and its history.
Yeah, and Norm has been fantastic. Mm-hmm. When I was first working there as a housekeeper, he would swing by, and I got lots of interesting stories and information about the house from him and mm-hmm. just how, his aspirations and what he enjoyed. It was really great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. yeah. And now... And Leslie, how about introduce yourself as an innkeeper now? We all know Leslie maybe a little bit more as the former tourism director in Haines, but she's got a whole new thing going on now.
Yeah, this is Leslie Ross, and I am the new owner of the former Summer Inn, which is now the Inn at Haines. So I also
so
am going
thing.
Through the brand change.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Brand change. House number one and the Inn at Haines.
The Inn at Haines, yeah. And it's, you know, the Summer Inn has a wonderful reputation and people have known it for years. And so I struggled with that, changing that name, but I felt it needed a fresh face. And I wanted people to know that it was under new ownership. Plus, I did I've done a lot of changes there. Similar to what Allie's saying, I am trying to restore it back to the 1912 beauty, but also upgrade all the furniture and bring in modern amenities.
Okay, now here's a question. Like, mm-hmm. and this would fall into the art of innkeeping, and probably both of you can take turns in this. But it's kind of tricky to do. I mean, even any kind of home remodeling or even paint in your own house when you're living it, much less when you're having guests come through. How do you balance? Like, you know, you want to do this project and that project, but make them short enough and quick enough to clean up
yeah.
that someone can stay there.
Well, I can say that I didn't sleep for about 3 months before I opened, because I was still working as tourism director and then coming home and working until 1 a.m. trying to get it prepared to open in May. So I used that time. But, yes, it's just you'll see, and I have little notes in my room that talk about the house to be forgiving of my little paint swatches I have in different walls as I'm you can't paint
you
have guests there because of the fumes mostly and and so I you can see areas in my house that are in progress, and I just have
yeah.
given a little note that you'll see areas that are in progress.
It's like gardening, isn't it, with old buildings? It's never finished. It's just an ongoing labor of love. It's like, yeah,
I didn't wear my coveralls in, which is what I was wearing earlier, because I'm crawling under the house to insulate. So it's the love of an old building.
Now, it strikes me, too, as, you know, if someone that stayed in old buildings or in bed and breakfasts or, you know, anywhere, even as a guest in someone's home, you know, that there's a certain art to making people feel comfortable
mm-hmm.
and being, you know, beautiful and nice and clean, but not so much so that people don't want to touch anything or sit mm-hmm. on anything or whatever. I mean, how much of what both of you are doing is, you know, strictly sort of maintenance and, you know, in they come and out they go, or how much is the hospitality end of it? And maybe I'll start with Allie on this one, and then we'll go mm-hmm. to Leslie.
A thing that seems strange to people who haven't done this kind of hospitality work, I think, is that my approach isn't unusual, I don't think, within that area, but it's theater, a lot of it. It's theater.
In what way?
In that you're using visuals primarily to create an impression, to create a profound and immediate impression, just as you would on a stage set. Lights come up, and that kind of thing. The lighting, the placement of furniture, whether people can move freely through through a space, whether they're drawn towards the thing you want them to pay attention to, and they're not looking at the patch of, that you haven't finished painting on the wall. So the look, smoke and mirrors and theatre to create just an impression that will stick with the person. And the first impressions obviously are very important. So I feel it's like theatre. And also with if you actually serve a breakfast or setting a table, how does it look? You know, when people walk in the room, I love it that they see the spread. We have a beautiful handmade table that Joey made.
Oh, Joey Jacobson.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, it's absolutely exquisite, and the guests comment on it all the time. So making that look pretty is really easy. But putting everything out on the table, and when the guest walks around the corner, the way we've got the room set up is they come around up the hallway, which you'll see when you come to the open house, hopefully, and they just go, oh, wow. There it is. It's all set out for them on the table. And I think that's part of it. It's like setting it out, which is where it moves from theater and into more sort of static art, is that to try and make everything like ready for people so that they can just reach for it. They can see it and it's ready for them. Mm-hmm. And ridiculous little tweaks, like psychological tweaks, like angling handles on jugs.
Leslie's grinning. Here.
Leslie's grinning. Too. I mean, this is like it's really, really important.
Really, yeah.
And I would just, I'm going to hand over to Leslie any minute. But basically, the art of it comes in doing all of this consciously, deliberately, and creatively, and it being invisible. Mm-hmm. It doesn't unless somebody is involved in this kind of work, or indeed theater itself, or the art. they shouldn't be consciously aware of these things.
Wow.
It should simply make them feel welcome.
You are sounding just like the protagonist in The Remains of the Day.
I know,
the butler,
and I did love that book.
You know, always, everything that you're doing is invisible, but mm-hmm. you're,
yes.
everything is conscious.
Precisely.
And you're one step ahead of
Precisely.
Every the people you're working
yeah.
for, and
yeah.
this is an English country house,
yeah.
but that there's...
I loved that guy. He was just
wow.
phenomenal. That character, yeah. Yeah, close to my heart.
All right, now Leslie's nodding her head.
Well, I love that it's like theater. I hadn't thought of it that way, but it is mm-hmm. so much. And I've had friends that aren't in the industry tell me I'm obsessive about different things in the house, like how the sheets are folded, where the
Quite
towels are
right
placed
too.
Correctly, and the towels have to be folded a certain way. But it's that thing where you see it displayed you know, and I think it comes with being an artist or having an artist background too, just mm-hmm. how colors are and how things are placed. And the breakfast table, I do the same thing. How you set
pictures.
Things and how people can grab things. And
yeah.
when you have a group of 10 people sharing a table, how to make things accessible. Mm-hmm. And a group of 10 that don't know each other.
Mm-hmm.
So making that comfortable
yeah.
feeling.
Wait, I want to ask just one question yeah. before Ellie jumps in. I love this. This is we could do this for an hour. This is so interesting. You have an additional challenge because you're living there with your daughter, a child.
I am. Yes, I was
going
to bring that up.
So it's her house too. So like, and she just come in and like when you say you've got to pick up your boots or don't put your
exactly,
feet on the couch, it's
yeah.
like sort of. Or don't help yourself
to
the table.
Yes,
it's like
yes.
or her friends come through. I mean, how do you balance out and keep every you know the theater of everybody happy and this is easy
yeah.
and we're all very comfortable and happy that you're here when some mornings that might not be the case.
Yeah.
Not that it, I'm
Most,
not.
No. It's a definite challenge, and luckily my daughter loves people and she loves like she plops down at the breakfast table with people all the time and chats around. And I normally don't. I'm there, but also going back and forth, being that invisible person that's
mm-hmm.
there
too.
When people want to
yeah.
ask questions,
yeah.
but not mm-hmm. intruding on their mm-hmm. time. But yes, with my daughter, the other day I had a guest walk in and I see her dirty socks laying in the middle of the kitchen floor. So yes, I do have that challenge. most people enjoy children and enjoy that youth. So it's. But Rio does call our upstairs area the place we don't have to keep clean. I try to tell her that we do still, not to the point of downstairs. But,
yeah. The upstairs, the place we don't have to keep clean. I don't know. I raised 5 children, and we kind of had that same rule. You know, if the living room and the kitchen, the entryway clean, your room, you're on your own, except for about, you know, once a week when
yeah.
you've got to wash your sheets or shovel out the stuff on the floor. But there was a difference between the public and private
yeah.
areas, even of a home.
Yeah.
Right? Allie, you're what? Nodding your head
what?
About
what? What do you
want to know? Well, what I want to know from you that you were nodding about the folding and the sheets and all those things. How important is that? I mean, as a guest, I guess when I walked in, I wouldn't say, oh, look at how those towels are folded. Mm-hmm. Like, is there how do you do it so that people don't notice it like too affected, but that it's neat and tidy? You know what I mean?
That's a really hard question. How do you do it?
Like that someone doesn't want to mess it up, you know, take the towel because somebody spent hours holding these towels.
That's a really good point. So it's got to be suggestive of accessibility. It's got to speak to people. I'm for you. So your towels are like, come on. I'm all plump and luscious. Take me. It's communicating availability. It sounds really cool.
That sounds if I can really add also.
Funny, but, you know, everything has to be ready, like the angling the jug with the handle towards people or something.
So they don't have to worry, like, should I take this?
It's offering itself. Yeah. Okay. You could probably get scientific about how you do that. I don't know.
I was also going to add cleanliness. So you can tell by the way towels are folded that they're clean. They haven't, you know, been... Because in my place, I have shared bathrooms. Mm-hmm. So the towels are in the room, and I, you know, have a note to bring your towel back to your room unless you want to... And then I have a bin. But my robes and towels are put so people can tell that these are clean and ready to use.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you were going to give, I've got a couple thoughts here, the advice for just a homeowner who says, you know, a homemaker, a housekeeper in your own home, you know, what are the neat sort of tricks of the art of an innkeeper that could translate into your own home for a couple things you can do to right away sort of make people when they come in the door feel welcome, or your family, or just a little quick thing that makes everything a little bit more intentional or artistic in a way.
Ooh.
In terms of hospitality.
You know, the first thing that comes to my mind is color, and that might be who I am, but I definitely have color schemes in my house that, you know, you can't just look at it and say, oh, it's a blue house, but I use color a lot in how I display things, and that includes flowers. I loved this year having Stephanie Scott's flowers delivered every Wednesday, so I always had fresh flowers on my table, and just putting little things out, even if it's a bowl of oranges, to have that color out. So I'm always putting stuff out to just to make things cheerier in dark areas or things like that. That's the first thing that comes to my mind.
Yeah, and that's something we spoke about yesterday, isn't it? Live things, fruit bowls and flowers. It's like something which is alive. That kind of vibrance communicates to people, I think. And I certainly do the same thing.
Well, and it's also like a level of care, too, because it means, you know, if the oranges are made out of wax, well, they've been in the bowl for months and could be dusty or something. So fresh ones mean they're, you know, everything is fresh and tended to, and there's people running in and out.
And also, there it is, offering itself to the guests. Mm-hmm. You know, help yourself. I think the one that is most dear to my heart and it's to do with the fact that I actually have a difficulty with light. I have extremely oversensitive eyes. I am kind of horrified when I walk into somebody's hallway in their home and it's like blinding light. You know that thing when you get caught in the headlights? For myself, that happens at a much lower intensity of light than it does for most other people. So I actually have to avoid people's homes where there's like too much bright light. But I'm an extreme case of that, but I think many other people experience the same thing. So, for example, in your hallway, if you've got a closet there that you have to get in and out of and use it in a functional way, and so you have a great big bright light right at the front door, that's great for you when you're going in your closet, but it doesn't say, hey, come in and be warm and cozy in my home to your guests. So I would say lighting. Consider lighting.
Lighting, just a lamp or something
that.
That's different.
And think of it in two ways, one for functionality and then one for hospitality and welcome. I think that's important.
And the other question, I guess we have a few more minutes left, a quick at the end. Do you have some like advice, certainly not necessarily based on personal experience, but what makes a good guest, or perhaps what is a not such a good guest for those of us who may be traveling this winter or going out and about or going to stay in a bed and breakfast? Is there some kind of things that are just real pet peeves with you, or that you realize that even the most well-meaning people are completely oblivious to?
I'll start. For me, if you're someone who's never stayed in a bed and breakfast, to feel comfortable coming out, it's not, most bed and breakfasts aren't set up for you to hang out in your room. Like I don't have television, in my room. So feeling comfortable coming out into the common spaces, mm-hmm. and part of a bed and breakfast, and I have a lot of European travelers that I think are more used to staying in guest mm-hmm. houses, is having that interaction with the other people. And most people staying at bed and breakfast want to have that interaction. So not being shy to come out and sit in the common spaces, if it's reading a book or if it's coming out for breakfast.
I agree.
That's one of the main things. Yeah. And it can make it awkward too, if you're not, like if you're trying to, you know, how people say, I don't want to get in your space. And I'm like, oh no, it's actually your space.
Right. Mm-hmm. I'd agree with that wholeheartedly. And the thing that strikes me is when there's glitches, particularly when the house is busy and there's many different, like there's couples and then there's a family or whatever, what makes them glitch is when there's people in the house that don't understand that it's not a hotel. Mm-hmm. It's not a hotel or a motel. Mm-hmm. It's somebody's home. And if people come into a bed and breakfast understanding that it's somebody's home and there are other guests in that home, and that, like Leslie said, when they work together, mm-hmm. if you take the shy ones and you can introduce them and get them working mm-hmm. with somebody and draw them out, then basically the guests look after each other. And that's fantastic to see. You can just step back and just let them enjoy each other. And to return to storytelling, I mean, that's something I have absolutely had a blast with my guests, the tales they have to tell, the places they've gone, the interesting lives. I mean, it's such a privilege to be in a position where you can hear all these wonderful things about people's experiences. Mm. You probably feel
the same.
Yeah. Isn't that fantastic?
Oh, I love having my table full of all these characters.
Lovely. Yeah. We're at the end of our time, and that's a perfect way to end it. Love having my table full of all these characters. I can see there may be books coming out of this. It's a great setting for a novel or even a memoir or how-to, My Life as an Innkeeper.
So 5 to 7 tomorrow evening.
Right, at the house number
4
one.
4 till 7.
Four until seven.
Oh, yes. Okay. So we made room for early birds.
Okay,
yeah, perfect. So the open house is 4 to 7 at number 1 Fort Seward.
House number one.
And this is all very important in the world of the internet is the branding.
Absolutely.
And Leslie, as a former tourism director, is nodding her head.
Yes.
And also the Inn at Haynes not having an open house, but I'm sure
you can stop by
and say hi to Leslie. Maybe the next time we'll have one there too, but just to see kind of how those things work. And I hope this gave you all a lot of food for thought on your own homes and on when you're traveling and on the work that goes in behind the scenes, the theater of I didn't know that the art of innkeeping was theater. And now that you think about it, of course it is. Really? It is.
Yeah.
It's the big wink. And that's nice. That's great.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us on there.
Thank you.
And thanks to Carrie and Sarah for coming on.
And
to our moose hunting readers.
Yes. And I know we couldn't get them to come on because one of them's in the woods still and the other one's working at the lumberyard and didn't want to be on the radio. So, again, there's at the Skipping Stone Studio tonight. There's going to be featured pottery from Carrie Cohen.
Tomorrow night, right?
Oh, tomorrow night. Sorry. Yeah. Right. Friday. And our friend Brad Schultz.
Yes.
Great. Portraits will be there too, and also the Haynes Brewing Company, the distillery. Lots of things to do for this first Friday.
So we are at the end of the program. Heather, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And if listeners have any suggestions, they can always give the radio station a call, anything they want to hear on the show. But it's 10:59. The World Cafe is coming up right here on KHNS, Haynes, Skagway, and Clequan. Thanks so much for joining us for Lynn Canal Art Matters this morning, and we'll be back next month.
God, it'll be November.
Ah!
Where does the time go?
Hope you have a great rest of your day. Thanks so much for tuning in.